When Cuba allowed for free farmers' markets, its citizens got food to eat, and lots of it. And its farmers earned money to spend, and lots of that. Now Cuba is making moves to shut down the farmers' markets again, which leads us to ask, what happened to Cuba Libre?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 661st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Wagga Wagga who are tuned in as we stream along the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello there.
Folks, when the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics collapsed in ruin, times got very tough for tiny little socialist Cuba. There was very little food to eat, so little that many families had to get by on one thin meal of rationed foods a day. In desperation, the socialist government of Cuba allowed farmers to sell their food in free farmers' markets, where the price would be established by supply and demand. In a very short period of time, Cubans who had money could buy food, and lots of it. And farmers who had food to sell could earn money, and lots of that. But the free farmers' markets created a big problem for Cuba's government grocery stores, where the price was established by the socialist government. You see, farmers did not want to sell their crops to the government stores because the stores would only pay the farmers a government-dictated fair price. And that price never quite equaled what they could get in the free markets. Furthermore, farmers selling food at the free farmers' markets were earning a lot of money, and thus creating a class envy in a society that is not supposed to have any class envy. To overcome these problems, Cuba is now making moves to force state controls over the free farmers' markets, making them, well, not free anymore. As a consequence, farmers are beginning to withhold their crops, and hungry citizens are shouting down the government agents policing the markets. This state of affairs leads us to ask, what happened to Cuba Libre? Here to help us find an answer, we have a gator on the road in Florida. That would be Bill Messina, who is a professor of ag economics at the University of Florida. Bill, welcome to the Food Chain.
I'm hearing you.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, gotcha this time. I don't know what happens. Sometimes the control surfaces here get fouled up, and pilot error is usually the case, and that would be the case right now. Well, Bill, you're a gator, right, on the road in Florida?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Good. Well, thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it. You're not far from Cuba, down there in Florida, and yet you are very far. Do you ever get a chance to get into Cuba and look around?
Academics are allowed to travel to Cuba. I actually haven't been down in about 2 years now, but I typically am down about once a year.
Mm-hmm. Is it as much fun as everybody says?
It's a fascinating country. I mean, when I travel there, I'm looking at agriculture and food mm-hmm. systems, and the productive potential on that island is immense. And the people are wonderful and friendly, and it's a fascinating place to work and to study.
So the potential for agriculture is immense, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It really is in Cuba.
And what makes it so, Bill, for those of us who haven't had the opportunity to see it, what makes it have all of this great potential?
Well, when people think of Cuba, they oftentimes just think of it as one more of the Caribbean islands down there. But it's very different than the rest of the Caribbean islands. It's almost as large as in land area as all the rest of the Caribbean islands put together. And it has very good soils, excellent climate, which the rest of the islands down there have as well. But the soils, so many of the Caribbean islands have a lot of coral. They don't have the good soils. Cuba has excellent soils, has good water resources. They face some of the same challenges for fresh water that we do here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But between the soils and the climate and the general water situation down there, there's a tremendous amount of agricultural production potential.
So they have the potential, but it's not quite working out. Why not?
I think it's a function of the lack of incentives in the planned economic system. I think that's the fundamental problem there. They made some changes in the early 90s that I'm sure we'll get to talking about a little later in the show that helped that. But now they seem to be sort of backing away from those market incentives. And
That's what we hear, reports of mass protests against the government at farmers' markets throughout Cuba. We hear people yelling and screaming at the government agents that are patrolling those markets and trying to enforce some kind of controls again. So I guess what's happening is Fidel and the crew are putting the clamps down on free markets again, right?
It would appear. It certainly would appear. And that's I don't think that's a good thing. I mean, I understand there are certainly some tremendous challenges that they face in feeding the populace down there, but I don't know that the moves that they're making now are going to help that situation in the long term.
Well, look, it's a fascinating history when you look at it. I had an opportunity to kind of thumb through the history of farmers markets in Cuba, and you see things kind of going in cycles, and we appear to be going in a cycle again. Let's go back and talk about how agriculture is supposed to work in socialist Cuba, from each according to his ability and to each according to his needs, right?
Absolutely. And what the government did in the early stages, the Castro government did in the early stages of the revolution, is they set up a food rationing system in an effort to ensure basic nutrition for all the Cuban people.
Mm-hmm.
Consumers were issued a ration book, and with that ration book, they could go to government ration stores and obtain all of the food they needed to feed their families for a month at very inexpensive prices, and some products were essentially free. And that system actually worked pretty well until the late 1980s. The government would collect food from the large state farms and cooperatives and distribute it through the ration stores, and the system functioned reasonably well until Cuba lost the massive subsidization it was getting from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the late 1989, in that range.
So the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe were kind of subsidizing the food prices, right?
They were subsidizing every aspect of the Cuban economy, really. They were pumping, it's difficult to put a hard and fast number on it, but they were probably pumping somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 to $8 billion a year in subsidies into the Cuban economy.
Wow.
And that disappeared almost overnight. And threw the entire Cuban economy really into a tailspin. For agriculture, the state farms and the farming system was heavily dependent on very large, input-intensive state farms.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of mechanization, a lot of fertilizers, a lot of agrochemicals used, and that was the basis for their agricultural production systems. And when they lost those fertilizers and the fuel to run the tractors, their agricultural output plummeted.
Boom. Yeah.
So the food supplies and the ration stores basically were very much constrained, and that put some pressures on the food system, understandably. There was food available on the black market, but the black market transactions were dollar-denominated or hard-currency-denominated. So people that were getting remittances from family in Florida or mm-hmm. elsewhere, or who were working in the tourist sector and getting tips from the tourist sector, they could purchase this food on the black market. But if you didn't have access to hard currency, you were out of luck. And
so it was real food for real money.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And as I understand it, you know, the way things were supposed to work in this kind of socialist control system was that farmers, you had the big state-run farms, and then you had independent farms or people who could grow food, and then they were given a quota, which is like a tax, which they had to pay to the state-run stores as well, which equated to what, 70% of their produce, something like that.
For the state farms, fundamentally everything the state farms produced went to the government.
Everything the state farms, but for private growers, you know, small farmers and people had, you know, market gardens and things like that, they could also sell some stuff, but they had to give 70% of what they grew to the government.
Well, technically, they were supposed to be selling everything to the government. They had a quota, and they had to sell that much to the government, and the government would dictate the price that they would pay the farmers, which was not very much. If a farmer produced over quota, the government would buy that and pay them a little higher price for it. That's the way the system was supposed to work. But in reality...
Oh, okay. Hold that thought, and we'll find out how things really work when we come back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. And today we're talking about Cuba Libre, what happened to the freedom in Cuba to grow food and to sell it and to buy it and to thrive. Apparently, Fidel and the crew are clamping down on the free farmers markets of Cuba. So what does this mean for the people of Cuba? And what does it mean for socialism in general? We will be right back with Professor Bill Messina, a gator on the road in Florida. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, the way it's supposed to work in a socialist agriculture like that in Cuba is that the farmers are supposed to grow all the food and give it to the government, and the government will put it in stores and sell it at very cheap prices to all the people, so all the people will get lots of food to eat at very reasonable prices, and everybody will be happy, and it works just fine as long as you have billions of dollars pouring in from outside to subsidize the thing and keep everybody happy, because the farmers weren't very happy in all of that. And then what happened when the subsidies disappeared, as they did from Cuba when the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics fell apart in ruin? We're talking with Bill Messina, who is the professor of Ag Economics, University of Florida. He is a gator on the road in Florida, and he's joining us on his cell phone, for which we are most appreciative. Bill, what happened when the former Soviet Union fell apart and the monies no longer flowed into Cuba?
When they lost the ability to purchase a lot of fertilizers and pesticides and fuel to run tractors and spare parts, agricultural output plummeted in Cuba, which, you know, was the same for every economic sector, really, in the economy there in the late 1980s, early 1990s. One of the things the government noted was that the productive system, the production on agricultural cooperatives, did not fall as much as it did on state farms. So they restructured a lot of the agricultural production system.
Well, wait a minute. How does that work? You mean they had co-ops and then they had state farms, and there was a difference between the two?
In the late 1980s, about 85% of Cuba's agricultural output came from these immense state farms, and only about 15% from a very small segment of cooperative farmers.
So cooperatives would be just farmers who are pulling themselves together into an organization and working together then, right?
Exactly. They small plots of land that were some very small holders actually still had title to very small plots of land as you know, that they owned. But most of the land was state land that the government allowed groups of farmers to come together and farm on a cooperative basis, sharing equipment and that sort of thing. But that was a very, very small portion of production in the late 1980s. And the government in 1993, they began to dismantle the state farms because they were so terribly inefficient and establish a much broader system of cooperatives throughout the country, smaller agricultural production cooperatives. And at this point, the cooperatives probably represent about 80% of total agricultural output in Cuba.
Wow.
So the situation is almost completely flipped.
So when the big institutional farms that were owned and operated by the government fell apart, It was the farmers themselves who pulled things back together and fed the world.
Well, the problem is, though, their agricultural production has not come anywhere close to recovering to the levels of the late 1980s. In fact, last year, the Cuban government acknowledged that about 80% of the food that was consumed by the people on the island was imported.
Wow, 80%?
Those are the official figures given by Cuban government officials. And that's an immense proportion to be for them to be relying on for imported food.
And that food comes from where?
Actually, since 2004, the United States has been the largest supplier of Cuba's imported food products.
And Cuba has to pay cold, hard cash for that food, doesn't it?
They do. They do. In 2000, President Clinton, towards the end of his term, signed legislation allowing the sale of food and medicine to Cuba for cash. But it was done on the basis of humanitarian need for the, mm-hmm. for the Cuban people. And Cuba didn't buy anything until about 2001 after they had a severe hurricane. But their purchases last year, Cuba bought almost $700 million worth of food and agricultural products from the United States last year.
Now, where does Cuba get
cash.
The money?
A portion of the food that they purchase from the United States goes into the tourist sector.
Mm-hmm.
Another portion goes into what they call diplotiendas or dollar stores, hard currency outlets where diplomats shop or tourists shop or business people from overseas that are living in Cuba shop. So they're
buying and selling for cold, hard cash then.
Right. Now, it's not a very large proportion of what they buy from the United States that goes into these markets, but they make very high markups. And as best we can tell, most of the funds used to purchase these food products were generated by profits from the sales in either the tourist sector or in these diplotienda stores, the diplomatic stores.
Hmm. Now, so we're in a situation where we're pretty much out of industrial agriculture then. The big industrial farms have kind of disappeared. We're relying on co-ops, and they're only supplying a minimal amount of 20% of the food needs of Cuba now?
That's the numbers according to the Cuban government.
So the question is, how do you increase production in a country that has the productive capacity to produce enough?
Well, Cuban people still understand the concepts of markets and incentives. They understand the concepts of supply and demand in the free agricultural market. They understand that on days when there's a lot of tomatoes in the market, the price for tomatoes drops. And so they understand how markets work, but the Cuban government has not been able to see its way clear to really relaxing the rules and regulations and allowing those markets to work and allowing the incentives
letting go
to be out there. It's a real problem.
So as I understand it, what happens is that those farmers who do produce now have to give their production to the state. The state puts that food in the state-controlled grocery stores where people are able to buy it for very low costs. However, nobody wants to sell anything to the government stores because the government's not willing to pay them a market price.
And sometimes the government is very long, takes a long time for the government to pay them for the money, the product that they do give to the government on these systems. So there's all kinds of disincentives. But the reality is they have to give something to the government because if they don't come close to meeting their quota, the government can take them off the land. And most of the people are not eager to lose their land. So the government has the ability to influence their activities and their ability to try to supply the quota.
So
requirements.
It sounds like what we have going there is kind of what, to paraphrase another expression, a Cuban standoff.
It's a very delicate situation right now, and there's a lot going on right now, and it's not clear exactly how it's going to play out. But the government's announcement that it's going to become more actively involved in the free agricultural markets certainly suggests that that's a major change. I mean, because the Cubans have been working really since 1994 on these more or less unfettered free agricultural markets. So this is a big, big change. The government has also announced that it's going to make some changes in the structure of agricultural production, although they haven't been at all clear
what
those changes are going to be. And I think all of this is driven by the fact that because of the tremendous cash crunch that Cuba's feeling, they're not going to be able to import as much food this year as they did last year. And I think they're concerned about food supplies generally.
So as I understand it, Cuba, in its short history, relatively short history, since the takeover by Fidel Castro and the socialist regime, has undergone periods where they tighten up and take total control, and then they let go and let people have their free markets and their food and their money. And then what happens is that the people get their food and their money, and the government feels it's losing control again, so it grabs control again.
That's certainly been the pattern since the late 1980s. Until the 1980s, they didn't do much relaxing of policies, but when they were forced to in the late 1980s, you're absolutely correct. You've seen patterns where they relax and then tighten, relax and then tighten.
And this from Juan Carlos Espinosa and Marcos Rideau, these periods of Fidelissimos, as he calls them, are characterized by tendencies towards centralization of power and decision-making, greater utilization of sectoral plans over more global planning, emphasis on volunteerism and mass mobilization, moral incentives and egalitarianism, as well as anti-market and anti-private initiative campaigns. Significantly, he says, these periods have been followed by severe economic downturns. And that appears to be where we're headed now. So when we come back with our Gator on the Road in Florida, Bill Messina, professor of ag economics at the University of Florida, we'll talk about how Cuba controls its agriculture and what the consequences of those controls are right back. Well, you know, when Cuba allows for free farmers markets, its citizens get food and lots of it. And its farmers earn money and lots of that too. But when Cuba moves to control those markets, something strange happens. The farmers quit trying to sell it, and the people who are hungry go even hungrier. And thus we're in this cycle, which appears to have happened over the years a number of times in Cuba since the Fidel Castro regime took over. Now, we're talking with Bill Messina, who's a professor of ag economics at the University of Florida, Gainesville. He's a Gator on the road today. He's joining us on his cell phone. Bill, it appears as though Fidel Castro is really the hardliner in the socialist control bit, isn't he?
He is, although, you know, Raul Castro, who's, you know, taken over power from
right.
his brother, does not appear to be any less any less so.
So you have the Castro brothers then, who are leading the hardline socialist cause to maintain all kinds of control over the markets, to prevent the free markets from flourishing, at least, to use them whenever they need to get food to the population. But then once the food is in sufficient supply, they seem to clamp down again and control the markets, and that seems to be what they're doing right now. But there's an other side to this, too. There are people in Cuba who advocate for the free market system, too, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's not a very large group, and they don't have much of a voice, but there certainly are those there.
They're there. So I'd like to ask, how does the Cuban government go about controlling this incredible operation here, because you're talking about food. You know, you're talking about people who are hungry, and they've evidently been very hungry down there for a while, going on some very thin rations. Some many families eating one meal a day of rationed food, and yet here's a country that's fully capable of feeding itself. So, how do you control the population in that situation?
Well, in reality, they haven't experienced too much in the way of food shortages really since about 1993-94. That was probably the low point in the period of the revolutionary government.
Well, then what did they do in 1993 to 1994 to get food into the system?
Well, that's when they, in 93, they broke up the state farms into smaller production cooperatives, and because they recognized that a smaller cooperative was able to be more productive, even though they only had very limited inputs, than these immense state farms. I mean, the huge state farms that were reliant on tractors and all kinds of agrochemicals. Mm-hmm. Just when they lost the inputs, they weren't able to produce much at all. So that was the big change in 1993. And then the opening of the agricultural markets in 1994 was hugely significant. That brought a tremendous amount of food out of the black market, provided some incentives for farmers, and really those two changes helped stabilize the agricultural system to a degree. But again, the government still was gradually becoming increasingly reliant on imported food products until, as I mentioned, last year they said 80% of their food comes from imported sources, which is an amazing percentage for a country with as much production potential as Cuba.
So here you have a government that essentially is broke, like most other governments around, and in need of feeding its population. And to do that, it has to let go of its control, it would appear, and provide the incentive for farmers to go out and grow so that they could earn money. And yet, if they do that, they lose control. And furthermore, the farmers become well-to-do, and then there's a lot of people who become very envious of well-to-do farmers running around. And in fact, don't the Castro brothers have institute periodic anti-corruption campaigns aimed at farmers making money and other people making money as well?
They do, although there's all kinds of mechanisms they can use to make sure that there's not too much income concentrated in the hands of farmers, for example. At periods when they have seen the prices getting higher than they wanted in the free agricultural markets, the Cuban government understood the concepts of supply and demand enough that they would just inject some of their own food supplies, some of the government mm-hmm. stocks, into the agricultural markets, bring the price down a little bit. And so farmers have done reasonably well, but it's not as though they've amassed tremendous resources. The Cuban government really goes out of its way to make sure that no one becomes considerably wealthier than anyone else down there. And there's a myriad of systems that they can do to help ensure that.
Now, what part does the Cuban press play in the management of things? Because it's not a free press. It's a government press. So
certainly government-controlled press. Mm-hmm. The government is very careful about introducing articles and coverage of issues that they want. If there's an anti-corruption campaign, they
find some corrupt people and go get them.
Absolutely. You didn't read much in the Cuban press. I don't think there have been mass protests in Cuba about this move for the government to become more active in the free agricultural markets. I think there have been some isolated instances at individual markets where people have, there have been some discontent expressed, but you don't tend to see the coverage of that in the Cuban press. You see the coverage of that in the international press that is writing out of Cuba.
So they pretty much spout the party line, and that's that.
The Cuban press, very much so.
Mm-hmm. How do the dissidents, how do the free market people, where do they hang out? Is there a coffee shop where they can hang out or something without getting into big trouble?
Well, I wouldn't classify the free market proponents as dissidents necessarily. There are a lot of farmers who have done well, who have recognized the power of incentives that certainly support the market-oriented reforms that they've seen in agriculture in Cuba. But I don't think any of them would necessarily classify themselves as dissidents. So they don't run into the same problems, for example, as the true dissident community down there that's fighting for human rights and those sorts of things.
They're just saying, hey, if you want food, we need to work it this way.
Yeah, and where do they hang out? I mean, the agricultural markets are where they do their business, and mm-hmm. so that represents a real clearinghouse of information and activity and conversation for them.
Well, looking at other socialist or communist regimes, we see they use things. I'm familiar a little bit with China, the history of communist China. And when dissidents seemed to get out of control, they would do things like have a campaign to let 1,000 blossoms or 1,000 flowers blossom or something like that, and encourage free speech, encourage people to come out and have their say, and then they'd chop their heads off. do they do that with dissident farmers, or what happens when a farmer is making too much money?
The I suspect that the biggest hammer the government would have would just be increasing that farmer's quota. Okay, you know, you had to produce X amount of volume to sell to the your quota was X amount of volume. So now your quota becomes X plus 10% or X plus 15%.
Sure, and then so you shut your mouth and mind your P's and Q's. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking about Cuba, and you are invited to participate. We have Bill Messina, professor of Ag Econ, University of Florida, with us today. And you, pick up your phones and join us. Anything you want to know about Cuban agriculture, how Cuba feeds itself. Any parallels with what you see here in the United States? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, it appears as though Cuba has the productive capacity to feed itself, but for some reason, it can't feed itself. It's buying 80% of its food from someplace else. What's wrong? Why it is this beautiful country unable to feed itself? Bill Messina, professor of ag economics, 80% is a huge deficit, and yet from a country that appears to have all of the natural resources it needs, what's wrong?
Well, I think it's just the lack of an incentive structure down there for their agricultural producers and the level of government control over what they produce. Farmers aren't free to produce what they want. They have to produce what the government tells them to produce, and the government tells them what they're going to pay them for their quota production. All of the market signals are
controlled,
disconnected.
So there is no market signals other than what the government official comes down the road and with his clipboard, and he says, this is what you're going to do, and this is how much you're going to do. And, boy, it really kind of turns you into a serf of some kind, doesn't it?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I mean, the only market signals you see are in the free agricultural markets and where the farmers have a tremendous amount of control. They can sell over quota production in their local markets. They can transport them into the city of Havana. And when you ask farmers how they make the decision where they're going to sell their food, they say, well, it costs us more to ship it into Havana than if we sell it in our local market, but we pay a lower tax to the government for the sales in the Havana market than we do in our local market. Their response is they monitor the pricing at the respective markets, and they figure out where they're going to end up with the most money left over at the end of the day. And the free agricultural markets are a tremendous source of dynamic market forces in Cuba, and that's what's so troubling about the fact that the government's talking about stepping in and exerting more control over those markets.
So why is the government stepping in?
I think that it's because they're not going to be able to import as much food this year. They want less food in the free agricultural markets because they need food to put into the ration system. So they're trying to exert more control over the entire flow of food in the country. That's the only thing I can think of.
And yet every time they do that, every time that Cuba has gone through these histories or these periods of what Juan Carlos Espinosa calls the Fidelissimo periods, 1966 to 70 and 86 to 90, every time they clamp down and exert more and more and more control, these periods have been followed by severe economic downturns. So it seems like the more control the government puts on the farmers, the less they get out of the farmers.
Well, I think there'll be some potential short-term benefits, very short-term benefits. You know, when you're talking about food supplies, sometimes you've got to do what's best in the short term and then hope you can reverse it and allow the market systems to begin to work again in the longer term. I have not been able to, and we have a group of collaborators we work with at the University of Havana in Cuba, mm-hmm. and no one seems quite certain what the longer term plan is. I think that the government is looking very short term now. We've got to make sure that there's enough food to feed the people, and we'll do what we have to do to make that happen, you know, for the next, really, few months, 6 months maybe, and then reevaluate from there.
Okay, if you're a farmer or somebody related to the ag economy, and you're cooking along and you're, you know, doing market economics here, you know, you're buying and selling. You know, the people want this, and you can do it because you're making money, but the government steps in. How do you see yourself when you see the government starting to look at you and saying you're out of control?
Well, I think what the response is going to be to this is there's going to be a lot more food finding its way back onto the black market. I think that's going to be the near-term response. Farmers are going to say, okay, I will continue to satisfy my quota to the government. And if the government exerts too much control on the free agricultural markets, instead of selling into those markets, I'll just start to move my produce, my extra produce, through black market channels.
Where are the black market channels in Cuba? I mean, the thought of going to the black market for a loaf of bread is kind of disconcerting.
It's the Cubans are immensely innovative, creative, in their ways of working the system and beating the system. And entire networks, back in the early 90s, before they opened the free agricultural markets, there were entire networks in neighborhoods or in apartment buildings where, you know, people knew that they could periodically get bread from the person living in apartment 10A, and they could maybe sometimes get fresh tomatoes from the person living in apartment 15C. And these very informal but rather efficient networks developed. The Cubans are very innovative and creative in that way, and I think that's what will start to happen again.
Wow. Well, let's make you the Fidel's right-hand man. What are you going to do? Bill Messina, professor of ag econ at University of Florida. Fidel Castro hires you to come in here and control this situation. And you have to control it. You can't allow it to go free.
Well, I would. The combination that they had of the ration system and the free agricultural markets, I think, really has worked reasonably well. That would not be what I would advocate as a long-term solution. I mean, as someone here in a market economy, ultimately you want to try to let the forces of supply and demand work down there, but you can't do that if it means people are going to go hungry. I mean, certainly not in that environment or any situation, any environment down that way. So the last thing I would do is go in and interfere with the operation of the free agricultural markets. I might try to increase the prices that the government offers for quota sale. I mean, maybe that would encourage...
Let me pick that up when we come back. And I'm also going to ask you the very, very big question, which is, can it happen here? What do you think out there? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Bill Messina. Well, a quick follow-up to the question of what would Bill Messina, econ professor, University of Florida, do if Fidel Castro came and said, Bill, I want you to take control of my agriculture and make it work better. And, Bill, I think what you said is that you would kind of recommend a little bit of free market and then a little bit of rationing, right?
Well, I think any huge, immense change to the system would be pretty disruptive at this point. So I think that the economy down there is going to have to rely on a ration system for some portion of its food needs for a while.
Okay.
But I would certainly advocate lifting the production controls on the farm sector, on the farmers themselves.
Well, then what happens when the farmers and the consumers get a little bit of taste of this freedom and like it and want more? What do you do?
Well, that's the huge question. The Chinese have been talking with Fidel Castro when he was still in power, and Raul Castro now, and they've been making the case that it's possible to relax the economic controls without losing political control, and the Castro brothers have both always argued that Cuba's different, and I think they may be right. I mean, their political control, I think, is in large measure driven by the economic control they have over the people, and that's certainly going to be there. I think the biggest challenge that the revolutionary government there is going to face is what do they do to significantly change their economy
Without losing control. Well, okay, now let me ask you the big question. Here in the United States, we have moves by the government to take more control of agriculture. We have the Food Safety and Enhancement Act that's currently working its way through Congress that would put the entire food chain under the purview of the U.S. government. We have the National Animal Identification System that would essentially identify every farm and farmer and farm animal in the United States and put them in a database. Do you think it's possible that we could end up in a situation like Cuba?
Absolutely not. I don't see these kinds of regulations or any of the kinds of legislation that's being considered in any way taking us toward the situation similar to what they have in Cuba. I just don't see that at all.
Well, that's good to know. So then what you recommend for Cuba then is a little more freedom, but not all of freedom, right?
Well, I would the changes that I would advocate in Cuba would be at the farm level. Allow the farmers to produce what they want instead of what the government says they need to produce, and then maybe allow the ration system to remain in place or gradually transition, but certainly to allow the free agricultural markets to continue to operate in Cuba.
And this is the market that China has adopted essentially throughout all of its industries, right?
I'm not familiar enough with the situation in China to really make a very valid comparison, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some semblance, but or some similarities, but I don't know enough about the Chinese system to.
Okay, so they need to import 80% of their food, and they have to pay cold hard cash for that food. They're out of money. What are they going to do, Bill? What is China going to do?
They don't have to pay cash for all of their imports. They have to pay cash for their imports from the U.S. They are increasingly getting offers of food sales on credit with extended terms from other countries. China, Vietnam mm-hmm. have certainly been sympathetic to the Cuba situation. Obviously in part because the political support that they're trying to send Cuba's way. Cuba's going to try to continue to get extended terms for its food purchases to get this situation in the short term. They'll still buy probably in the neighborhood of $550 million worth of food from the U.S. this year.
I got to go. Bill Messina, thank you so much for joining us. And folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.